quite often I'll test a story, the idea of, is this an interesting story, by taking out the celebrity's name. Let's put Mrs. Miller's name in here in my head and like, is this an interesting story if I'm telling you about this, about your neighbor, about your cousin?
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. So today is a special day because we have Dan Wakeford in the studio. Dan was named editor-in-chief of People Magazine in 2019, which is a publication that I think I've been reading since before I can basically remember. Dan had served as deputy-in-chief for 4 years before that, so he's got a long relationship with people. And prior, he was editor-in-chief of In Touch Weekly and Life and Style Weekly. So, Dan, welcome to Future Proof.
Thank you for having me.
Very excited for this. So, in addition to what I just said, you know, who the heck are you and what do you do on a day-to-day basis? How do you describe it?
So, as you said, I'm Dan Wakeford, the editor-in-chief of People Magazine, or the People brand. I oversee the whole brand, which is basically the biggest magazine brand in America. The AAM, the Alliance of Audited Media, actually last week anointed us with that status. So it's very exciting. My job incorporates all the different platforms where People content can be accessed. So that's print, web, mobile, video, and we've got a total audience of about 100 million people.
Yeah, so that's no pressure there. You know, I want to say I feel like our audience is slightly bigger, but it's okay. We'll let that slide. I think one thing that's really interesting to me, what attracted you to celebrity journalism? Because I feel like a lot of people, it just naturally speaks to, you know, like we're just obsessed, for lack of a better term.
I mean, I came into celebrity journalism not as a fan. A lot of celebrity journalists come into like celebrity journalism, the idea of like, I love celebrities. It's never been about loving a celebrity for me. It's been about loving storytelling. And I just think celebrities are the central protagonists of storytelling these days. And it's just exciting storytelling.
Well, speaking of something exciting, one thing that we always do is just try to divert people into a quick lightning round before we jump into everything else. So you ready for that?
Oh, I am, yeah.
Okay, and obviously you don't know any of these things beforehand, so just to try to stump you a bit, who's the most intriguing celebrity that not enough people necessarily know about yet?
That not enough people know about? I mean, I don't know if it works like that completely. I mean, I think not enough people know about Kate Middleton, for example. I think people project their fantasies onto this blank canvas. And to me, it would be very intriguing to know what she is really, really like.
Yeah. And I think obviously, since you've got a lot of relationship, let's say, with the coverage of the Royals, you know, we're going to jump into that a little bit. But another thing I want to ask you, something about yourself that you've never admitted in an interview previously.
I don't think I've ever admitted in an interview that I'm a twin, actually.
Oh, okay. Were you the older one? Or
I was supposed to be, but I was pushed out of the way at the last minute.
Oh, that's really annoying. That's by a paparazzi, no less. Yeah.
No, he's a teacher.
Yeah, that's great. Love how, inevitably every set of twins that I've ever met, they're not doing the same thing. There's always like a night and day kind of component to that. So,
We're both doing good for the world.
Yeah, yeah, and in different ways, but yeah. What is it like hanging out at John Legend's pool?
It was pretty fabulous, actually. He was one of the most fun and easiest celebrities you worked with. He didn't know he was going to be jumping in the pool, and we're like, would you jump in the pool? And he just did it straight away. They're such a chill family. They're so easygoing. There was probably about 30 of us going in and out the house. Chrissy was totally cool. The kids were just adorable. It was an amazing time and great music and fun.
I call her Chrissy, too. That's how close we are. Yeah. And what would it take, let's say, for somebody such as a podcast host to become the sexiest man alive? Is that within the realm of consideration, or is that probably low likelihood.
We can always consider things. Sometimes the story is bigger than the star. So if you have an intriguing story, you could one day possibly get the cover of People magazine.
Okay, yeah, the window is closing pretty quickly on me, but
we've had some pretty older men in our Sexiest Man Alive cover.
I think that, you know, definitely if you kind of build out different, you know, sexiest man above 90, sexiest man above 100, you know, I'm sure that, but it's a little bit more difficult. But thank God I've worked in beauty enough, so I've got the hookup for the products that I might need to age appropriately. But, so yeah, as a society, going back to the heart of everything else, why do we love and appreciate and need celebrity journalism? Because you touched upon it with the storytelling aspect, but there's something innately connected between storytelling and celebrity, right?
Yeah, I think humans have a fundamental need for storytelling, and celebrities are the natural protagonists for storytelling. And I mean, if you're telling a story about somebody, they essentially do become famous and a celebrity if it's an exciting story in real life. I think there's two variables here with human nature. I think there's escapism and then there's learnings. Life is hard. There's so many studies that show that women are suffering such burnout. And you want to, when you've got 90 minutes on your own once a week, you want to read People magazine, you want to escape and enjoy yourself. And whether that's escaping into the primal fears of a crime story or the glamorous world that you don't live in, I think that escapism is something really something people crave. The other element with celebrity storytelling is learning and learning from these experiences. I quite often tongue-in-cheek joke, half seriously, that People magazine stories are possibly the modern Shakespeare. It entertains people with comedies and tragedies, but these are also morality tales, and there's things that you can learn from. I think people is escapism that can make you a little bit smarter. And there's an intellectualization to gossip and celebrity that you can learn through others. Like, what can you learn from Lori Loughlin and Felicity Huffman's actions during the school admission scandal?
Yeah, I never really thought about it that way, but I kind of liken it to, you know, we all really need some type of escapism, you know, whatever it is going to be. And obviously, all of the data shows that, you know, we are now overworked as a society. We're so focused on productivity that we often do things that just naturally make us less productive. And sometimes actually picking up, you know, something that is a bit of escapism that doesn't, quote unquote, matter, you know, to your day-to-day life is actually a nice break.
And I think there is learning through osmosis from that as well. So that's great.
Yeah. How important is it for you and your team to find compelling storylines with respect to celebrity journalism? I think of the Meghan and Harry thing, you know, that storyline, for example. I mean, to me, it was like, this is amazing. Like, this is a great storytelling that's wrapped up that you just have to find a way to, you know, get it out in the right way. No?
Oh yeah. When that broke, there was a time we were running around the office. It was such a compelling story. I mean, it's so important to find interesting stories. Media has changed so much in the last 10 or 20 years. Media is so disparate now. The shows that I watch and the celebrities I know and care about are not the same people that you know and care about, because we're not watching the same things. In the 80s, the whole of America was watching Dallas, and you could do a People magazine cover saying, "Who shot JR?" You can't do that with a show now because the media is so disparate. Stories are what connect us as humans, and good stories from people are a demography breaker. They cut through all generations, and quite often I'll test a story, the idea of, is this an interesting story, by taking out the celebrity's name. Let's put Mrs. Miller's name in here in my head, and like, is this an interesting story if I'm telling you about this, about your neighbor, about your cousin?
Yeah, and it's funny because now I'm thinking, actually, if you had a Who Shot JR, people would say, thanks for the spoilers because I'm 2 weeks behind on my DVR. So things really do change. I mean, how surprised were you, you know, going back to the Meghan and Harry story, you know, those recent developments, was that something that there was any type of inkling? And is the element of surprise sometimes the thing that makes or breaks a story?
The timing of it was, the immediacy of it, exactly when it happened, was a big surprise at the time, but it wasn't a big surprise. I didn't have a sense of the immediate time scale. I did contemplate doing a cover 3 weeks before, saying, are they moving to America? Well, like, we were aware that this was an option. But from the moment Meghan came into the picture and they got engaged, I remember saying to our Royals editor, Michelle Tauber, this isn't going to be smooth sailing. They're going to be in LA within 3 years. I didn't think it would happen quite so quickly. Basically, Meghan's a very dynamic woman with a purpose, and she wants to make a difference, which is tough within an institution like the monarchy. It's very restrictive. It's very difficult to have autonomy. But our Royals team is so clued in. We've got people in London. We've got a high number of people, reporters who are dedicated to this. I really think for an American outlet, we're the number one outlet in the world, because Americans care about the Royals more than the British. So we certainly knew this was brewing.
That's also just a quick aside that I'm curious about. Is it ever interesting to you how much American fascination there is with the Royals, given the fact that, you know, we fought, you know, quite a while ago to you know, have our own country, and now this is this thing that's just, like, fascinating.
I mean,
I
find it so fascinating. Basically, you guys don't have to pay for the Royals. That's the starting point here. Also, you've grown up with Disney, so there's this ultimate fairy tale projection onto these principal characters, and the idea of, like, you could be a princess too is what evolved with Meghan Markle, because she was American, and that really opened up the fairy tale and built a lot more excitement here.
Yeah, and that's an interesting way of thinking about it, actually. How important is diversity, you know, to the future of celebrity journalism and representation that looks like the world, you know, outside our windows, you know? And do you, as a journalist, have an obligation to cover more diverse faces in order to better represent society? Or, as a business, do you just feature whoever, you know, performs best? Because I've been, you know, as a journalist, I've looked to see there's a certain topic that just pops, and in my head I'm thinking maybe it doesn't benefit society necessarily to cover this topic more, but it's doing well, and it's a for-profit business, so a lot of questions there, but I'll let you.
Yeah, there are natural always tensions between those areas, but I think I have a responsibility to myself, and that I want to present the world that I want to live in. And I understand representation from a personal perspective. In the last few years, I found myself very emotionally connected and hit hard by particular stories and books and films. And when I was watching things like Lie With Me, when I was reading books like Lie With Me by Philip Besson, or A Little Life by Hanya Yangira, and watching Call Me By Your Name, I realized I was in tears and really emotionally hit by these stories. And I realized that these are all gay stories. And I realized I'd never had my stories told as a young man or growing up as an adult, that my stories hadn't been represented in media. And then to take that even further and just to think not seeing racially diverse faces on magazines and being represented, what that must be like. So that really put it home for me, and I empathize with that audience. And there is a responsibility to do that. Obviously, there are commercial pressures, but if you follow trends and data too much, you end up driving a brand into the gutter, I think. Mm-hmm. Following the lowest common denominator subjects, following the same celebrities and the same story arcs, as you say, you lose the serendipity and surprise that really makes a great story. And you lose the vibrancy and freshness of a brand because you're just repeating the same thing over and over again. In the last year, I've done more diverse faces on the cover of People magazine than ever before, whether it's Tyler Perry, Viola Davis, Jada Pinkett Smith, Tamron Hall, so many. And I did it because I thought it was right. But there's also commercial value to doing these things. And there's economic benefits of being diverse. You're opening up your audience to more people. It does take time. And sometimes you do take a hit first because there isn't as much engagement. But diversity is the right thing to do for so many different reasons.
Yeah. And I like that, you know, you're able to kind of tie it back to the commercial, because I think it's true. If you're able to be a little bit ahead of the market, you know, generally you're rewarded. But if you're too far ahead, then that can be a net negative. So how do you try to figure out how to actually be slightly ahead, but not so far ahead? So just to lead by example, almost.
I mean, we have so much data around us, so we can test things out digitally a lot more easier than putting somebody's face on the front of a magazine. We can do stories on them without taking the risk of putting somebody on the front of the magazine. We have a lot of research. We look at a lot of data. We have a lot of consumer insights, which really helps us take a stab of working out when is the right time. Even with any celebrity, whether that's Chip and Joanna Gaines, who are one of the biggest selling people, we had them on our radar for 3 years before we put them on the cover of the magazine.
So, and how would you say celebrity journalism is evolving overall? Because I think that there's so many different factors at play, right? You've got, consumer interest is changing. We touched upon diversity. Obviously, there are a lot of emerging media platforms and competition that, is coalescing around you. So how would you say it's evolving?
I mean, we talked about how it's evolving from a celebrity perspective, that there aren't so many big stars anymore and stories are more important within my strategy. But it's obviously evolving, as you said, from a content perspective. Print is changing. The revenue of People, we're very lucky, is still growing from print. And the newsstand is still very dynamic for People, but it is reducing. People magazine will last in print forever, but the way the print is distributed is changing. It's still very much an anchor to the People brand. Celebrities want to be on the cover of People. It opens up access. There is prestige. You'll be the most talked about person in America if you get the cover of People magazine. So our print product makes an enormous amount of money, but of course we're developing the storytelling on every platform possible and that's available to us. Digitally, we have 77 million uniques, and we have television and video shows. We were one of the first media brands on Snapchat. We've just actually become the first brand to communicate to our readers via text with the community platform. Our digital director, Zoe Ruderman, spearheaded this, and it's a really exciting way to engage with consumers. We were there at the Oscars, behind the scenes with all of our reporters. Readers were asking questions, and we were answering these things. So we're exploring every single different platform possible. We want to be wherever our consumer is, and that's including her earpods, podcasts with loads of different plans. We're doing Alexa Flash briefings, and we've had successful crime podcasts.
But, so there's so much there, right? And I think that in some ways, obviously, that becomes more of a challenge as the leaders in situations like yours where they have to say, okay, do I invest in A or B, right? That's what it used to be. You had two or three things that you had to think about from a priority standpoint. So how does it change the way that somebody like you has to operate when there are all of a sudden 15 or 20 different things that you can do to build audience?
I mean, we work in an integrated newsroom. So we have one content stream and we have different verticals. So we have experts in each different vertical and expert teams, and they can work on any different platform. Obviously, nobody is 50-50 split between print and digital and TV and different platforms. You have experts in those fields, but then everybody is adaptable for those different platforms. If I have a digital film editor who works a lot of the time on digital and they have an amazing relationship with Jennifer Aniston, they're also going to be doing the cover story on Jennifer Aniston. So basically, we're doing all things. Sometimes there are decisions and you do have to follow economic pressures and work out what is our emphasis here. We make a lot of money from print, so that is always going to be, that is a high priority, but we're not sitting on our hands with the other stuff as well. We're developing it at the same time. The most important thing for me here is essentially making sure that when we're on those platforms, that our brand is quality. I look at different scenarios for the future, looking at whether there is an extreme amount of supply of information with a wash of synthetic data, or whether we're in an economic upturn or downturn, or there's a reduced supply. No matter what, if a brand's quality, it is going to survive. Quality storytelling will survive. So my job is spending a lot of time of making sure the quality on all of our platforms is to the level it needs to be.
Yeah, I think that actually, now that I'm thinking about it, to me what's interesting is I kind of liken the fact that you've got a print publication similar to almost why I tell people when I was going to publish my books, I wanted a respected publisher instead of just self-publishing, which is okay, except for the fact that everybody can self-publish. And just like with when you think about digital, right, everybody can have a digital story written about them in theory, but there's a finite amount that will ever fit within a print publication. So that to me is the value and virtue of having print live on 100 years from now, when a lot of people might have said, oh, what would be the value in it? And like the value is the scarcity, the fact that there are only X number of articles that can ever be written. So I'm just wondering what you think about that. And obviously you've got a bias towards, you know, imagining the print having quite a lot of longevity, but it seems like it connects with a natural human need to have a, you know, a finite number of stories that are highlighted, as opposed to, you know, 100,000 that could theoretically be on a website.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, particularly from a celebrity perspective, they want to be on the cover of People. There's a prestige there that you are being told that you are important and that you are getting a story. But there is an element of curation that these stories are interesting and that they fit the mission of the magazine and that they're providing something for the reader, something emotional that they can get. There's a physicality of a print magazine that you just love, that it's tactile, it's indulgent, it's beautiful, and it's important. As you're saying, it is important because somebody is choosing this in a finite space, that there is a limited amount of pages, a limited amount of covers, and that you are being told that this is important. There is a weight there.
But what do you think, okay, just to kind of put on my cynical hat, which I try to do every now and then. You know, what are some trends that celebrity journalism needs to lean into in order to survive and thrive and just kind of acknowledge almost that the world is changing? You know, I'm sure you're doing a lot of those things now, such as investing in emerging platforms. But what would you say about celebrity journalism in general in order to you know, continue to evolve?
I mean, I think there really needs to, you need to be telling stories in depth. There needs to be an exclusive element, that you need to be an expert in your field in any storytelling these days. In an age where everyone can know a little bit about something because of the internet, what makes you stand out as a brand is having a deep, credible knowledge. And I think younger and older readers just want deep stories. They want stories to be emotional and evocative and thorough. So I think that is something. So to be an expert for people, we're experts in the entertainment world. We're experts in the human interest world. It is not true unless you read it in People or people on people.com. I really think we are the New York Times of the entertainment world, for sure. And I think with successful storytelling, be sure of what your mission statement is and what is your mission. People is clearly a myth-building magazine. We are the best in the world at this. But if you want to be a myth-busting magazine brand, you've got to be the best in the world at that. The problem is nobody is doing that very well at the moment. And in a world of fake news, you really have to be good at that to really be credible. And so you've got to be an expert in what you do. And then there's obviously being an expert on your platform. If you're being an expert in print these days, you've got to provide something visual, something that you can't get in your earpods or you can't get on your phone. And it's got to be beautiful visuals. And if you pick up People magazine, which I encourage everybody to do, obviously, that you'll find that like you're getting visuals in there and design that are probably better than the monthlies these days. We spend thousands and thousands of dollars on exquisite photography that you can't get anywhere else.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because, you know, we are very visual as a society. Of course, we're naturally attuned to striking visuals. And I think that there's been a lot of research to indicate that you can look at something on a screen. It's not the same thing as looking at it in print, just like print is not the same thing as seeing something in front of you in person in 3D and feeling that and connecting, having some type of emotion there. So, you know, like I think that that's a thing that I think people kind of miss when they just assume that print will be 100%, you know, dead and gone. It's like, well, actually, it creates a certain type of emotional response that people might not have otherwise.
I think it definitely creates an emotional response, and the way you process it, whether it's the pictures or the words, you process it differently in different formats. I think processing formats has changed in recent generations and different ages. With millennials, I think there was a rejection of print. They grew up with curating their own content, and that whole idea that I choose I've got the choice of the internet. They've grown up with computers in schools. They're choosing, they're having autonomy, they're creating their own content, and being given a print magazine or choosing a print magazine, they resent it. They feel like it's like homework. They're being told what to read. Whereas Generation Z are changing. They've grown up in a world of fake news. They don't trust to get their content now from social media in the same way. There's a trust and association with print products that they understand. And when they're even consuming their information digitally, they're more likely to go to brands that have a print legacy brand, because there's a trust associated with that.
Yeah, I think that's completely true. When I was, just as an aside, I was a digital journalist for Inc. magazine, and what I noticed is that there was a certain halo effect for all the digital journalism by virtue of the fact of there being a print publication. And even for me as a journalist, I was able to, you know, say that I represent this organization, and there's a cachet that gets transferred to that digital property. But it only works if you still have that longstanding print property that's been around and has been respected for years.
I think that's happened so many times with magazines that it does have to exist. And it may not exist in the same format. As I said, a print magazine could be distributed for free, but there is still that prestige that there is a print magazine there.
Yeah, have an Entertainment Weekly go to monthly and still be called Entertainment Weekly. You know, perfect example. Can celebrity journalism maintain its edge when everyone increasingly has the ability to capture celebrity scoops by themselves, or at least they think they do? Because, you know, you do have also, by the way, another thing that I'll just add on to that is you have something that at the advent of people, you didn't have celebrities that had Twitter that would direct message their fans, or, you know, or same thing on Instagram. So in some ways, that's been something that I feel like might keep the trusted publications on their toes.
Certainly. I think so. We're talking about the idea that celebrities can define their own, tell their own stories on their own social platforms. That is our biggest competition, Instagram, for our consumers' attention, and also for celebrity scoops. I do think that has changed in recent years. To begin with, everybody's like, I can control my own message and I can do that. But we're a very respected journalistic publication. We bring authority. We tell you that this is significant because it is coming from People magazine and people.com, and this is right and this is true. Also, when a celebrity releases something from their own social channels, they're preaching to the choir. They're speaking to their own audience. Their fans are preaching to the already converted. When you're on the cover of People magazine or getting a story in People, you're reaching a wider audience of people, and these are people who aren't already on board with you, and these are people who are going to become more sympathetic with you or believe your story because it's from a credible outlet like People.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, even though we're talking about celebrity journalism, what you just said, I think, can really be applied to brands in general. You know, it's brands have a certain credibility that they need to just basically hold themselves accountable. So, and frankly, I think that it's the same thing is true of other mainstream media outlets is, to lean into your credibility and to continue to invest as opposed to just, try to, I guess you could say, have the lowest common denominator type of content, as you mentioned before. You know, investing and making sure that you've got the quality can go a long way towards keeping the credibility of the brand intact.
I mean, we're doing that at Meredith at the moment. Meredith is People magazine's mother company. We're developing like very luxe editions of celebrity in the celebrity space. The idea of Chip and Joanna's magazine Magnolia is probably one of the most successful magazine launches in recent years, and it's creating something that you want to cherish, focused on celebrity, something luxe, and you want to keep. The new Rachel Ray magazine is an example of that as well. We've got just launched a Property Brothers magazine. Aisha Curry is having a magazine. So very niche ideas and niche audiences following celebrities, but very passionately, and getting something you can't get anywhere else that really is quality. And I can only see that continuing.
Just to kind of build on that for a second, I think that, you know, that's something that I really tried to do with this podcast is, you know, I realized the idea of narrow casting mm-hmm. and to almost break things down into different, you know, sub verticals, which, you know, I know you do with your nav, with the digital property. And really the magazine itself is broken up into, you know, a few different verticals or areas of focus. I mean, do you think that you're going to naturally just see within the celebrity journalism world more focused properties, or, you know, how do you know as a journalistic entity whether or not you should launch a sub-vertical focused on a particular hot-button, you know, topic like the Royals or, you know, infertility even, you know, interesting things like that?
Well, with digital, you can launch something digitally a lot easier than putting the investment, first of all, into a print product. So we can launch and try things digitally all the time. And we have so much insight into that. Data is huge at Meredith and in journalism at the moment. Meredith's capabilities with data and information are huge because as a company, our scale is wider than most media companies. So we're at, and we have a lot of taxonomy related to data, and it's a lot deeper than other places. And we use that to inform our storytelling, looking at trends, looking at consumer habits and trends all the time. And having predictive insights into how the consumers live and to better understand them. So we're starting off with that information of what they need. And then also just looking at the numbers and engagement of areas. It's easy to start a vertical and try something digitally and then see how that can carry across to a print product, a television show, a podcast, and what have you.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's really that relationship, what I've always said, is that you can take digital in some ways and use it to reinvest into your core product. You know, social listening and whatnot can help you improve the product in general.
I mean, that's huge for us. Digital informs print all of the time. Quite often at the beginning of the day, I attend the audience development meetings where we're looking at the big stories of the day, and it does obviously inform. It's a huge resource for us of like, what are the big stories? Why are people clicking onto this? And to see and consider whether that fits into print.
So how does a property like People think of how it needs to strategically spend its time between print, digital, and other modes of distribution? Because I think that that's something a lot of people struggle with now is, you know, you see there are certain things that are going to be the future and there are certain things that are the bread and butter for now. And just to kind of think about that from a prioritization standpoint, do you have a way that that you'd think about it or you'd recommend other people start to think about that those decisions?
Well, we're lucky at People that we do have a huge amount of resources for both, for print and digital and new platforms. But we look at things about whether they're core to our mission and work out how does this fit. I don't believe the magazine's mission has to be the same on all platforms, but there has to be some relevance there. How a television show lives and how a podcast lives doesn't have to be the same as a story in the magazine. So there's essence of looking at what's right for the brand. Also, you've got to look at how much money you're going to make for them, make with a brand extension, and evaluate it, like, have we got the resources? Have we got the investment for that? So, but luckily, we also have the same content stream. We have the same great relationships with celebrities that we can then work on telling their stories on different platforms. So there's a lot of economies of scale there. But yeah, sometimes it does come down to numbers of like, are we going to invest? How many people have we got to spend on a podcast? How much time have we got to develop a television show?
Yeah, it really strikes me that I think one of the challenges somebody like you, and, you know, we ask this question a lot of our guests is, you know, how do you correct for your own biases? You know, there are certain things that you naturally just have a bias for believing, but your job is to think a few years out and to think how you're going to make this property continue to grow and thrive. How do you do that to take basically like almost a more pragmatic view and say, listen, I love print, but we also have to invest in these other things? Or, you know, traditional terrestrial media is great, but maybe we should be spending 10% less time on it, things like that.
I mean, you hire people who are amazing at their jobs and better you at their jobs and more experts in all of those different platforms who challenge you every day. And people who are excited about what they do and to and are on the cutting edge of knowing about new things that are happening before they're happening and before they're a thing. And so you get ahead of the curve and you launch new products like we just did with our relationship with community as we're the first there, and to be innovative. And we have innovation meetings where we're sitting working out what do we want to do, what is innovative, what is new. And we have meetings where we're trying to encourage a culture of that.
Yeah. Are there particular trends that you're paying attention to, just in terms of anything that's on the horizon that you think is worthwhile, you know, anything from TikTok to a particular trend within society that you might just think that there's something to be learned from paying attention to?
I mean, I'm being very proud of my work with our mental health initiative, because I think that is hugely in the zeitgeist. We launched a campaign of let's talk about it, trying to help people and reduce the stigma of mental health. And I think that is like telling these stories and helping people. I do think celebrity journalism can help people. And I think there is a big emphasis on that, and working with celebrities and to reduce the stigma of mental health has been really important to me. But we do that in lots of different ways, whether that's sustainability and using celebrities to pass on this message and to do good for the world. I feel like the huge amount of like good feeling about the idea of just being kind, just simple things like that in the zeitgeist have had so much impact for me, and letters from readers when we launched a kindness initiative. And I do think there is a sense of really trying to create platforms that really do that. And obviously with the practical platforms, with TikTok and the other new ones, and just making sure that you are delivering your stories on every platform possible, that is interesting. We're trying to take people off the printed page with the print magazine, with smart codes, so that you can try on the makeup that a celebrity's wearing in the photo on your own phone and upload a photo, and exciting, innovative things like that. But I think essentially at the end of the day, stories are going to last forever.
Yeah, I think that's a really fantastic point. It is really interesting to me how, you know, and I like that you really touch upon the themes within society that you can tap into, and the things that you believe that if you start to talk about them more, they're going to pop, simply because I think too often people do focus a little bit more on, well, Snapchat launched, so I guess we've got to get on Snapchat, and you jump into the technology without thinking, you know, of your overarching strategy and where society is going in general, right?
I mean, that's been something since I became editor-in-chief, to be thinking like, what do I want to do here? One of the last things my old boss, Jess Cagle, said to me as he congratulated me and said, oh, you've got a lot of power in your hands and to do good, and what do you want to do? And I had to think, like, I know I can put out a kick-ass magazine. That's in my blood. I can create compelling content every day of the week, but doing good for the world is a different, and I just had to really think deeply about what people want and what do we need. And I thought mental health and kindness and sustainability are things that the readers were really craving, and the direction society was going in.
Yeah, and to me, my humble opinion, that is probably what a good editor-in-chief can do. It's not just rallying the troops. It's having a little bit of a vision and not just a reactionary, well, what did well, so let's drive that topic into the ground and not do anything else. So, well said. But this was really fantastic, Dan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What a great conversation with Dan, I have to say. I told you it would be good. I have so many follow-up questions for him offline. So thanks so much to Dan Wakeford and his team. And if you like what you just heard, and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Futureproof, as that's the number one way we get this show in front of people like you. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Futureproof.